If you'd like to support Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/GoneColdPodcast. There are several different tiers available with perks to go along with each, including an exclusive series available only on Patreon. Each episode will feature a different individual who has committed murder in the state of Texas. We'll outline their crime or crimes and let the listeners decide if they are responsible for others. We sincerely appreciate all donations as they help cover the costs associated with research and production. Thanks, y'all. Now on to the show.
The Gone Cold Podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
I'm going to look it up on the internet. And when I looked, I was just amazed that her case didn't show up on Fort Worth's whole case. It didn't show up at all. It was just like it didn't exist.
Five years after the murder of Mildred May, and one year before the abduction and murder of Carla Walker, another killing in the month of February took place. The second victim in what the press referred to as the February slayings was Becky Martin. Born Becky Berline Whitaker on August 12, 1951, in Fort Worth, Becky was one of four children in her household growing up. She attended Trimble High School, also in Fort Worth. A straight-A student, Becky was intelligent and described as happy and friendly. She never met a stranger. Becky was still in high school and working as a waitress on nights and weekends when she met David Martin, who was working for Lone Star Gas Company at the time. David was a little older than Becky, but they hit it off as friends right away. The two got to know each other well. David frequented the Burger Drive-In where Becky waited tables on Miller Avenue. Eventually, they started dating. Even before Becky finished school, the two spoke often of marriage, and though she wanted to drop out of high school so they could tie the knot, David insisted that they not marry until after she graduate. Becky graduated in 1969, and her and David wasted little time getting hitched. They welcomed a baby girl into their lives shortly thereafter. Becky began taking classes at Tarrant County Junior College in the fall of 1972 and had also begun waiting tables at Kipp's Big Boy on University Drive around that time. David described Becky as a great mother who wanted to take their daughter everywhere with her. He said, quote, "She'd have taken her to school with her if she could. She did take her to work with her sometimes. We did everything together. We had two 10-speed bikes with a carrier on one for our daughter," end quote. David, too, had just undergone a change in employment. He no longer worked for Lone Star Gas by this time, having taken a job as a truck driver for Fort Worth Independent School District. On Wednesday, February 7, 1973, Becky and David were in the process of moving to their new home in Everman, a Fort Worth suburb. They'd begun moving the day before. Their baby daughter had caught the flu, so it was presumably hectic managing moving, the two working, and caring for the toddler. Becky was forced to skip class on Monday the 5th to nurse for the sick child, and though David expected her to skip on Wednesday, she had an exam and insisted that she couldn't afford to miss it. It was cold and raining, and Becky drove to the Tarrant County Junior College South Campus to attend her English class.
Well, it was, we were in the process of moving from the Polytechnic area in Fort Worth to Everman. We had gotten a little house, a lease-to-own house there, and we were moving that evening. Well, it was really raining hard. Becky had class that night at TCJ. It was called TCJC then, Tarrant County Junior College. And she had some final exams that night that she had to go take. So we had a load of furniture on the pickup and had a tarp over it, and we were moving it. we got to the new house, and she said, well, I got to go to school. Just right up the road, it wasn't probably 2 miles up there to the school. So she said, I'll be home early. I know this stuff, and I'll be able to finish my test early and leave as soon as I'm finished. And normally she didn't get home. She wouldn't get home till about 9 o'clock at night on a normal night at school. But she said, I should be home by 7:30 at the latest. I said, okay. So anyway, I stayed at the house, and she was going to help me unload the truck when she got home. And our daughter was really sick. We had a little baby girl. And at the time, she was really sick. She was running a high fever, so I didn't want to get her out in the rain and stuff, you know. And well, anyway, we stayed there in the house, and 7:30 came and went, and 8:30 came and went, 9:30 come and went. I was getting really worried by then.
A classmate told David that she did indeed attend the class and take the test. She finished the test early and left class around 8:30, and considering she was a model student, this is an indication that she'd done well. Later Wednesday night, at about 10, Becky hadn't shown back up to the house. David worried she might have had car trouble, bundled up their daughter, and went looking for her. He drove the campus's parking lot row by row and finally spotted Becky's car. When he got out to inspect it, he found mud spattered on the seats and the dash, and his wife's books and class notes were scattered on the floor of the back seat as if they'd been hastily thrown. Because of the weather, the tires were caked with mud, and there were muddy footprints all over the inside of the car. The keys weren't there, but David had another set. The car started and didn't appear to be having any issues. Note cards Becky had been using for English class were found approximately 150 feet from the automobile, strewn by the wind in the lot.
So about 10 o'clock, I was really worried, so I bundled up my daughter, put her in the truck, still loaded with furniture, and we drove up to the school. Well, there was a few cars scattered on the lot, parking lot, south parking lot of the school, and it was still pouring down rain. And I saw her car sitting out there, and we drove up to it, and the door was ajar on it, and there was papers all over the ground soaking wet, and it's wind had blown them and scattered them. And I picked one of them up, and it was her papers, her name on them. So I really panicked then, and I got back in the truck. I didn't touch the car or anything. I drove around to the security office, and they were sitting in the office in there, and I tried to tell them what was going on, what the deal was. So they said, well, we'll check it out. And I said, well, I got to do something with my daughter because she was just burning up with fever. My mom and dad lived about 2 miles up the road the other direction toward Fort Worth there, right up off of Wichita Street. So I called my mom and dad, and I took my daughter up there to them, and I took my daughter up there. Well, my dad, we got in his truck and come back to the college campus. Dad was driving, and we went out there, and the car was there, and talked to security. Security said, well, there's nothing we could do. You know, I probably rode home with somebody else. But anyway, I called the Fort Worth PD and reported it, and they were forever getting there. We were waiting on the lot, and they were forever getting there. When they got there, they said, well, there's nothing we can do about it for 48 hours. Or no, I'm sorry, for 72 hours. It's just considered a missing person. They said, maybe your wife left you. I said, no, you know, I mean, that wasn't an option. So they wouldn't do anything for 72 hours. They wouldn't touch the thing. And so anyway, I was just panicked. And it was, by this time, it was midnight or later. First thing we done is drove around. They said, well, maybe she went home with somebody, another family member or something. So we drove around to different family members' houses. Of course, the lights were out and they were sleep, and there was no cars, you know, movement or anything. So we just went by our house, our old house and our new house several times. So we just kind of drove around in a panic most of the night.
Becky was petite, standing only 5'1" and weighing 100 pounds. Her hair was shoulder length and reddish brown in color. That evening, she had left the house dressed in Levi's bell bottoms, a red shirt, and a blue corduroy jacket. Though the Fort Worth police deemed it necessary to wait, ostensibly considering Becky to have gone off on her own and to be in no danger, David Martin did get some help the morning following Becky's disappearance.
The next morning, my dad had taken me out to my house in Everman, the new house, and my daughter stayed with my mom and dad, and mom was taking care of her. Next morning, this chief of police, I think it was the next morning, about mid-morning. I slept because I was wore out. But about mid-morning, I got a knock on the door, and it was the chief of police from Everman. And that's the little town we had moved into. He wanted to know that he had heard over the radio, dispatch radio or something, the incident last night. And then I think he knew one of the security guards or something up at the school campus. He asked me what happened, and I told him the story and told him what we did the night before and blah, blah. Well, anyway, he said, do you mind if we go up and look at the car? I said, no, not at all. So I got clothes on and rode with him up to the college campus and looked at my wife's car. It was still sitting there in the same spot, and the door was open. But this time, you know, the rain had quit, and it halfway cleared off. And he opened the door easily. He put on some rubber gloves or something, opened the door so he wouldn't mess up anything if they had fingerprints or anything. Anyway, there was claw marks all over the inside of the door panel and all down the outside of the car. It was an obvious struggle. You know, there'd been an obvious struggle. She had a white car. Of course, it had dirt all over it, and so the claw marks showed up real easy on the outside, and the inside was red interior. And it had clawed completely through the Naugahyde interior, you know, scraped the Naugahyde off. So it was real obvious. It was a struggle in there, and a severe struggle at that. He said, do you mind if I get involved in this? He said, this is obviously an abduction. And I said, no, I appreciate all the help I can get. So he contacted Fort Worth police, and I don't know what they told him, but he got frustrated with them. But anyway, he took it on his own to call a investigator somewhere out, and his police department paid for it for him to do a forensic investigation of it, and he proved beyond a shadow of a doubt it was an abduction. So he got a hold of Fort Worth police, and I guess it really embarrassed them. And so they got gung-ho on it and decided to send some detectives out. And anyway, they sent a forensic team or something out and done the same thing he did. He had already done, the chief of police had already done. And so that's when Fort Worth got involved in it.
David, the Everman police chief Billy Tuttleman, and Fort Worth detectives searched several different areas of the city for clues as to the whereabouts of Becky over the course of the next several days. Plenty of calls started pouring in after the Fort Worth Press and the Fort Worth Star-Telegram reported the disappearance of the young woman. One possible witness was found, but it is unclear if the information he supplied ever bore leads or was even connected to Becky's disappearance.
Detectives started questioning people that were at school that night, and it might have come out the door and seen anything, you know, out on the parking lot, so on and so forth. There was one young man that said that he had to walk out over to the other side of the drive that come up to the building. His mother picked him up there, and he had to run out to the car there, and it was raining real hard, but the only thing he noticed was a light blue pickup truck driving around out there, around up and down the aisle real slow by her car. And it was one of these Ford Ranchero trucks. He said it was a car type truck. And that was the only person that supposedly saw anything. Everybody else was still inside taking their test and finishing up. So that was about 7:30, about the time she said she'd be getting out. And he had finished his test early and was going out too. Well, anyway, that's the only witness or anything that they had. He didn't see anything really other than that pickup driving around.
David searched for her for hundreds of hours, as did the Fort Worth Police, the Tarrant County Sheriff's Office, and the Everman Police, in an unofficial capacity. Becky's car was looked over, of course.
Well, after they got through with their forensic thing, they told me, you can take the car home. You know, they wasn't going to impound it or anything. So I took the car back to the house, parked it in the garage, and we picked up some of her papers out across the parking lot.
On February 11th, David and five of his friends combed Carter Park for what was reported to be a woman's body, but found nothing. The police dispatched a helicopter to search the north end of Eagle Mountain Lake after a tip that a body was found there, but it was reported that only a dead cow in the lake was found. Fort Worth Homicide Lieutenant Detective Oliver Ball reported receiving and checking out many tips that were called in on Becky's case. A county judge vacationing in Mexico sent Lieutenant Ball a photograph of a young woman he thought to be Becky. Ball examined the teeth of the woman in the picture, though, and ascertained that it was not her. There seemed to be no trace of Becky Martin at all, anywhere. The Fort Worth Police Department was stumped.
So they told me that there wasn't anything that did check into it, and there wasn't anything they could do at the moment. Fort Worth Police wouldn't tell me anything. A few days went by, I got a call from them. They wanted to know if I could come up and take a look at a gentleman that they had in custody. So I said, yes, I would. So I wouldn't go up there by myself. My dad went with me, and we went into this room with the two-sided glass, you know, where the person in custody couldn't see through the glass. But anyway, this old boy was crazy as a loon. He was had a split personality and everything, and they were asking him all kinds of questions. They finally deemed that he wasn't the one. You know, he was, I don't know whether he had alibi from somewhere else or what. Anyway, he wasn't the one. That's the only contact I had with him for almost 6 weeks.
On Monday, March 26th, 1973, at about 5:30 p.m., James Edward Anguish, 26, stopped his car near a culvert on Old White Settlement Road for reasons never specified. The two-lane asphalt road is an extension of White Settlement Road that runs westward toward the county line and mainly served dairy farms and a small housing development on the western edge of the county. Where the three had stopped was approximately a mile from a Carswell Air Force Base munitions dump, about 3 miles from the base itself, and around 3 miles from General Dynamics as well. Anguish's wife, Maxine, and his mother-in-law, Ruby Little, had been visiting R.J. Smelly's dairy farm just up the road. They were walking along the roadside when they saw what looked like a decomposed body inside the culvert. The area surrounding this culvert and the point in the road in which they stopped was more or less prairie land. Thick brush is prevalent around the creek, and the culvert was located in one of several clusters of small woods scattered throughout the area. They hurried back and told James Anguish what they'd seen. He thought it had to be a cow or some other animal. According to Anguish, when he went down the culvert to look, it was immediately obvious that the remains were human. He went to the first house he came upon and called police. When sheriff's deputies arrived, they determined that the body was too badly decomposed to make any identification on the scene. Investigators' first thought was that it was Becky's remains, but after examination at the Tarrant County Medical Examiner's Office, Chief Medical Examiner Felix Quotes said the conclusion was that it most likely eliminates this lady, meaning Becky Martin. He went on to say, "But we think this is possibly a female. It's not a teenager on account of the condition of the teeth and the extensive dental work this person has had. These teeth are close together. Miss Martin was supposed to have had a gap in her front teeth. They, meaning the police, are going to check a list of missing persons, but it looks like it is a middle-aged, possibly elderly woman." End quotes. There was no clothing found on the near skeletal remains. Dr. Quotes said this individual could have been strangled, shot, or stabbed through the stomach. He determined that she was killed elsewhere and then placed in the culvert. Police found no clues as to the identity or cause of death after searching the area thoroughly, or at least that is what was reported to the press. A single shoe was found near her body, but was speculated as having been washed into the culvert by recent rains. The culvert was dry and clean, other than some debris and a beer can pushed up against the body, suggesting that flowing water had occurred at some point while the body laid in the culvert. Detectives agreed that the female had been murdered somewhere else and subsequently dumped, though the medical examiner had ruled it out at first. David Martin was convinced that the remains were Becky's. On Tuesday, David stayed home from work sick. The police called and confirmed the body was indeed Becky's. Becky's friends and former neighbors gathered shortly thereafter to be with the family. David wiped his face with a wet cloth, his daughter dancing in and out of the room. "We haven't told her yet," David said of his child. "She knows her mother is gone, but that's all. She kind of senses something is wrong, but we aren't going to tell her for a while. She has a bad heart, and she has trouble when she gets excited. It could kill her. She can't afford to get excited," he added. Becky's teeth were positively identified by an x-ray of her bridge work by dentist H.L. Stewart. Wednesday, 2 days after the body was found, Becky Martin's remains were positively identified. Gwotes listed the cause of death as homicide. He concluded that she may have been dead a month or more, but because of the condition of the body, he was unable to determine the cause of death. The night before the remains were found, David was staying at his mother's house. "David had nightmares all night long," Mrs. Margie Martin told reporters. "I was up all night with the baby, too. She had them all night. Maybe somebody was trying to tell me something." David knew the minute he saw the body on the evening news that it was Becky. "It was covered up except for the hair. The hair was showing," he told the press. "She had long, wavy hair. It came all the way down to her waist. Beautiful hair, fixed all in curls the night she disappeared," he continued. Though he was told it wasn't Becky, he never had doubts that the remains belonged to his wife.
Seventh week, I was at my aunt's house one night eating dinner, and we were watching television, and the news came on, and I saw that they had found this body out on a dead-end road out toward Carswell Air Force Base ammo dump. Anyway, they had found this body, a man and woman had been out on a drive on Sunday afternoon, saw a skeleton laying in the mouth of this culvert. So, of course, he called the police, and they got out there and found this skeleton. And this was on the news. I was watching this. And when they showed the coroner picking up the skeleton, you know, the putting it on the gurney, they showed it on television. Well, they had it covered up. The hair on the skeleton fell out, and it was real pretty, dark olive red. And the newscast about it later on that night was saying that they deemed that that was about a 65-year-old woman that had stumbled around or something and must have fallen and died. I told my aunt, I said, I had never seen a 65-year-old woman with dark auburn hair. You know, most of them is black, gray, or silver or something. But the next day, I marched up there to the coroner's office, and I said, "Well, I want to know the details on this body." Well, of course, they wouldn't give me any details about it. Because I wasn't law enforcement, so I got a hold of the detective that was supposedly handling the wife's case. He told me they were handling this, and that wasn't her. It was a 65-year-old woman, and give me the same runaround the news media had said. And I was persistent that that was not a 65-year-old woman. So I got a hold of Chief Tuttleton. That was the chief of police that had helped me out in Everman. And he got an opportunity for us to go up there together. And I talked to the coroner, and I said, "Look," I said, "how about we check out some dental records?" I said, "My wife was having dental work done at the time, and she hadn't had it completed." I said, "What would it hurt if you called in her dentist and had it look at this skeleton?" So the coroner agreed to it, and sure enough, it turned out to match perfect to my wife. And so anyway, then they were all embarrassed again. The coroner's office and Fort Worth PD and everything, you know, was embarrassed about this because it was, turns out to be her. And she had been missing 7 weeks, exactly. Her wedding rings was never recovered because when they found the body, the skeleton, the only thing there was a little bit of meat left on the middle finger on her left hand, right out on the tip of her finger. Everything else was just a skeleton. We got another coroner in there to take a look at her, because one that was there, old Felix Quotes, that argued she was a 65-year-old woman. I didn't care for him. We got another coroner in there that asked him, could they tell how she died? And he said, "Well, with just the skeleton there," he said, "there was no marks on the bones anywhere. So it had to be either a strong blow to the neck or strangulation. But the esophagus would cushion it, so it was either a strong blow to the esophagus or strangulation. So we really don't know." And They couldn't tell if she'd been molested or raped. You know, there just wasn't enough there to look at. And they thought it was awful strange that she had deteriorated that fast in 7 weeks. But where they had her laying, it placed her in this culvert. It had rained a lot during the 7 weeks, and water flowing over just decayed the body real fast, is what the coroner said.
The week her body was found, a rancher who worked at General Dynamics was out looking for cattle thieves. He came upon a man parked on the side of the road near the culvert where Becky's body would later be found. The rancher couldn't remember the exact day, but said he decided to talk to the driver to ask if the man was having trouble. The man replied, "No, we are all right," but the rancher didn't see anyone else with him. He wrote down the license plate number of the vehicle, he told police, and carried it in his pocket for 3 days until he threw it away. The rancher later told reporters that it was the dumbest thing he's ever done. From their hesitation to begin the investigation when David reported Becky missing to their lack of acceptance of his input, David Martin's frustration with the Fort Worth police's handling of his wife's case was titanic and lingers to this day.
They were embarrassed big time, one over Chief Tuttleton, proving that it was an abduction. The chief told me that had they started the search for her that night, like they should have, there would have been a strong possibility she could have been found alive. So they were embarrassed there, and then they were embarrassed big time the second time when the coroner was insisting that that being an old lady's skeleton, and it turned out to be, you know, a young girl. So it's a sad thing that an individual like me, just a common Joe, can observe more things than the trained professionals can, you know, and they just don't seem to accept any of your thoughts or information or anything like that. They got their own train of thought and they won't listen. I feel deep inside that there was a cover up there for some reason, form, or fashion on her case. I really do. That's why there's not any more information out there. And I don't know what the cover up was, the reason for it, or who was behind it, or you can tell yourself by looking at the news articles and the information that's available to you. There's a world of difference in my wife's information and some of the others. I just honestly feel there was some kind of cover up there for some reason. I don't know whether somebody was involved in what happened to her that might be embarrassing to the police department, or, you know, I don't know. It's just me thinking out loud, so.
Little is known about possible suspects or persons of interest in Becky's case, other than the fact that there were very few. There is one suspect known to have been questioned and cleared by a lie detector test. Then Tarrant County Sheriff's Office investigator Jim Minter traveled to Austin to question a man who was arrested there and was a known rapist. He said it was a long shot and it presumably turned up nothing. Minter himself tirelessly cross-referenced Becky's case with Carla Walker's kidnapping and homicide a year later. In fact, some persons of interest in Becky's case became so by becoming possible suspects in Carla's murder.
10 years down the road, I tried to contact them. Every time I saw something on the news that was related, there was a case related where they arrested a young man that was a Sunday school teacher, and they found all of these trinkets in his wall in a sack. I got a hold of them and asked about that. They didn't contact me. I contacted them. Anyway, they had me come up and look at some of these trinkets to see if it was any of my wife's. It was just costume jewelry, you know, pieces of costume jewelry, but none of it belonged to my wife. Probably in 05, just before I retired, I got a call from a Fort Worth detective that said he was opening and looking into these cold case files. He was comparing my wife's case with Carla Walker's case, and because there was so much similarity. But that's all I ever knew about it. Her and my wife both disappeared right there within the same time frame. You know, it was a year difference, both within the same month area there, time of the year. Same circumstances where they found her and the remote area and things. So I could see the similarity where they'd look for this. I've never, to this day, ever got a positive on anything and wasn't doing me any good to ask questions. I wasn't getting anywhere. thought to myself, I'm going to look it up on the internet. And when I looked, I was just amazed that her case didn't show up on Fort Worth cold case. It didn't show up at all. It was just like it didn't exist. And I tried to call the police department, but they never would answer my question. They just kind of give me a runaround. Why was it not there, you know? I never did get an answer out of them. They kept putting it off.
Tommy Ray Nealon was thought to have been a viable suspect for Becky's death, only after being suspected in Carla's more than a year later. William Ted Wilhoit was seen as a good candidate for the murder by the public, thanks to local legend John Terrell's insistence that he was responsible for Carla's death. David Martin, though, has always suspected something else entirely.
You know, something that always amazed me, just totally amazed me, was my wife come from a violent family. The daddy would go get drunk, come home, beat the kids up, and there was three girls and a boy, and he'd make them stand there and watch him beat the mother up, too. Well, anyway, he had come down to our house when we lived there in Poly and beat my wife up. I come home one night, me and a gentleman that I worked with, and caught him in the act of doing that. We escorted him out the door and called the police. Of course, they didn't do nothing. But anyway, so that was the reason we decided to move. My wife was just scared to death of it. The witness that they questioned, the police questioned the night of her disappearance, said he saw this blue car-type pickup driving around. Well, my ex-father-in-law had one. That was called his drinking car. And he'd go out drinking and drive that one because it was all beat up and banged up already. But not once, I asked and asked and asked, not once did they ever question him. They never called him or family or anything in and questioned him. Now, they claim they went by his house a couple of times the night she disappeared. Well, me and my dad went by there. I was going to tell the father-in-law what happened and, you know, inform him and let him at least know what was going on because that was serious. And his blue pickup was gone. Well, the police said that they went by there and knocked on the door and nobody came to the door and there was two cars to drive. Well, yeah, he had two other cars but he used this old truck to go drinking in. And the reason nobody came to the door is the mother-in-law was deaf as could be. She'd take her hearing aids out and she couldn't hear nothing. I tried to explain that to them, you know, but they never once would call him in and question him. And another thing is he caused this big scene at the funeral home behind the scene and come in there drunk and ranting and raving, wanting to see the body and blah, blah, blah. I didn't object to him seeing the body or anything, but the funeral director, I told the funeral director, I said, go ahead, let him see it. Well, he went there and saw it, and then he come out just sober-faced, but he got violent again right outside the door, and they had to call the police and have him escorted out of the funeral home. He didn't come dressed to come to a funeral. He didn't come. He wasn't at the funeral. He just there in Race came. And, you know, all that stuff put off a heavy red signal to me that there's some involvement there somewhere. I'm not accusing anybody. I don't want to get anybody's career in trouble, you know, because that's all in the past. But I'm just wondering if, since he was family and they had family in the DA's office, they had family in the sheriff's department at the time, I'm just wondering if, you know, that wasn't part of a cover-up. I don't know. I don't know for sure. It was my father-in-law's sister's two boys. Yeah, one of them worked in the DA's office. He later become a DA, and then his brother was in the Tarrant County Sheriff's Department. And another thing that sounds fishy about this whole story, too, when my wife was missing, during the weeks that she was missing, my father-in-law had a second cousin to my wife. I don't know what the exact relationship was there. He was quite a bit older than my wife, but he was a second cousin. He was the father-in-law's drinking buddy, and he'd go drinking with him all the time at night. And he went by my mother's house to see, he claims he went by there to see how my daughter was doing, you know, because she had that heart problem and things. But he never asked anything about my daughter. All he could do is try to question my mom about, well, if they heard anything about, they found out any information, they got any clues. I mean, he just really drilled my mother about that instead of what he supposedly come by for. And my mother told him, she says, no, but he said, she told him as soon as they find out something, if they find out something definite and they tell David about it, she said, I'm afraid he's liable to kill whoever it is. And it scared that guy to death, I guess, because he got in his car and left real quick, she said. He didn't say bye or nothing. He didn't show up for work that night. The next day, somebody went over to his apartment. He wasn't married. Somebody went to his apartment to check on him because he didn't show up for work that night. He had already emptied out the apartment. He was long gone. Nobody's seen or heard from him since. Doesn't that sound a little strange? I'm going to tell you what my opinion on all this is, and it's just an opinion. It's not, no facts involved here. But I think what happened is the father-in-law was mad because we moved and didn't tell him about it. He knew Becky went to school at PCJC, so he went out there that night, drove around until he saw her car, parked beside the car till she came out, confronted her, and he probably slapped her around or hit her a little too hard. I think he killed her, and he didn't know he killed her, didn't mean to. It was just him being mean, and then he didn't know what to do. So I think he hauled her off, and him and his drinking buddy carried her out there wherever they dumped her, that dead-end road, and that's why he was gone all night. His pickup truck wasn't there at his house all night. And the reason I feel sure it's him too is because they said whoever dumped the body out there where they found it had to know the area because it was so remote. It was a dead end road. Well, he grew up out there in that area and he rabbit hunted all that ground. So, you know, there's too many things that fall that direction, and it just totally surprised me that the police never even called him in and questioned him. Hearing all of the things, you know, just kind of points that way. I don't know, but I'm sure he's probably, the father-in-law's probably dead by now. I hadn't had any more contact with him. He never did come by the house to check on my daughter or never call or nothing. I mean, everything just points that direction, and I just totally amazed at the police. Couldn't see that and didn't even question about it.
As if the anguish that Becky's death caused wasn't enough for David and his baby daughter to have to undergo, more uncertainty would enter their lives.
Turns out my daughter wound up with some heart trouble. And I was having to pay for her to have radiation treatments on her heart. Anyway, it was my daughter stayed with my parents, or both of us did, me and my daughter.
Becky Berline Martin was laid to rest on the afternoon of March 30th, 1973, at Mount Olivet Cemetery.
We made funeral arrangements at Shannon's funeral home over on the north side. She had a real nice funeral. I was working for a security company part-time at the time, and I was doing hospital security. I worked for the Fort Worth Pillars during the daytime, and then I worked this security job at night. And this security company, the head of the security company took it upon himself to volunteer to give her a military style funeral. So we had the 21-gun salute and the military deal. And they said Shannon's Norris said it was the largest funeral they'd ever had. And she was buried at Mount Olivet over on the Sylvania Street there in Fort Worth. And the funeral procession reached all the way from the funeral home over to the cemetery. All one big line. Like I said, they said that was the largest one they'd ever had. And it was not just family and friends. It was tons, just people that had been following the story, you know.
If you have any information about the murder of Becky Martin, please contact the Fort Worth Police Department Cold Case Unit at 817-392-4307. Next time on Gone Cold Podcast, The February Slangs, Part 3, June Ward. If you would like to support the show, you can do so by subscribing, leaving us a review on iTunes, sharing the podcast with a friend, or by stopping by our Patreon page and making a small donation. This helps cover the costs associated with the research and production of the show, and we appreciate all donations more than we can put into words. We'd like to extend a huge thanks to David Martin for his contribution to this episode. You can subscribe to Gone Cold Podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. We can be contacted on Facebook or Twitter by using @GoneColdPodcast. We have a closed Facebook discussion group where we exchange ideas and post pictures pertaining to the cases we cover, as well as discuss many other cases from just about anywhere. So please join in. Be sure to check out our friend over at thetruecrimefiles.com. It's an amazing resource to learn about unsolved cases you've probably never heard of, and a few you may have. TheTrueCrimeFiles.com is full of stories that are presented well, respectfully, and with great insight. Check it out. You'll be glad you did. Thanks for listening, y'all.